Thank you. At 3:17 p.m., I'm calling the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order today in room 124. It is Monday, April 24th. And members, please turn off your cell phones or turn them to silent. Members present. Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Knopp, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Wool, and myself, Chair Keto. We have a full committee today and a quorum to conduct business. Support staff today are Kelsey Goodell on the LIO moderator station. Yes. Welcome back, Kelsey. And Caitlin Ellis as our recording secretary. And today we have one bill on the agenda. Thanks to my staff, Bianca Carpinetti, for filling in for Tally Teal today. Bill we have before us today is House Bill 229, Oil and Gas Business Bond. We intend to hear this bill, open public testimony, and hold it. So we do have bill sponsor to come forward, Representative Seaton, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the committee's scheduling this today. I am Representative Paul Seaton. I am representative for the Lower Kenai Peninsula House District 31.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. House Bill 229 suspends the surety bond or the cash deposit requirement for oil and gas businesses operating in Alaska until January 1st, 2019. The suspension will provide the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development time to develop the regulations needed to do that. Some background is that the surety bond was incorporated in House Bill 247 last year. The necessity for this was that there had been small companies that don't have very deep pockets come to Alaska and go bankrupt. And the bankruptcy code allows the bankruptcy court, whether it is in Alaska or whether it is in Houston, Texas, to go back 90 days from the time that bankruptcy was filed for and come back to Alaskan businesses that have supplied materials or labor to the company and make the company repay that money and then give it to secured creditors. And we had that, I think you've got in your packet, a newspaper article where Buccaneer that came to the Cook Inlet and with a jackup rig actually financed in large portion by ADA. The state of Alaska filed for bankruptcy, and people had supplied fuel, had supplied water, had supplied moorage and other services, and the bankruptcy court came back and said, oh, you need to repay the money that you received for the fuel that you supplied and they burned in their rig. You need to give that to us so we can give it to secured creditors. And so we looked around trying to figure out how could we prevent unsecured creditors, suppliers in Alaska, from being at risk for secured creditors that didn't do their job. In other words, there's investors, secured creditors, that didn't do their due diligence on a company, and now they can come back and claw back money from Alaskan suppliers for 90 days prior to when that bankruptcy was filed for. And trying to get over that unfair situation, that's what this surety bond was meant to do, or cash bond, and that is what the bill was, the problem is, and the department is here to testify that there's been some glitches in how to provide that surety bond to oil and gas companies. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's the pretty simple bill is just delaying the imposition of this so that the department has time to get their regulations in place.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Do we have questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Knopp?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton, I appreciate bringing that forward, and I'm intimately familiar. I had a lot of friends who got stung in that, as you know as well, being down there. But my question is, that particular bankruptcy law is just not applicable to oil and gas. It's everything. And so we know we had a fish processor went bankrupt here, and some of that same stuff happened through them. So does this bill specifically to oil and gas, or is this going to be applicable to every industry? I know you rolled it particularly for HB 247, but I'm just wondering, does it have any broader implications?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, no, it doesn't have broader implications. It's specific to oil and gas companies that are get a license, and the requirement terminates when it goes into commercial production. And the reason for that is that at least then there's something to attach to, so people could sue. There are other requirements. So at that point in time, we weren't trying to make something that every company would have to have on the books forever, but just until we have new people come into Alaska, don't have experience here, then we have several instances where they've gone bankrupt, especially when we're doing oil and gas tax credits or otherwise financing like the ADA loan through those. So the state has some handle on that, but there was no way to try and circumvent the bankruptcy court. And so the purpose of this was to go to unsecured creditors. And so if we had something that was targeted just payable to unsecured creditors, then the thought was the bankruptcy court might not be able to take that unsecured creditor directed payment and give it to secured creditors.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Justin, then Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton, just to sort of clarify, I took a bankruptcy law course a long time ago, but is there a way, through the chair, is there a way for regulations to be written that would allow for our unsecured creditors to trump secured creditors and be acceptable with the bankruptcy code?
And through the chair, Representative Josephson, that was the purpose of directing it through a surety bond that was, you know, was directed to pay unsecured creditors. You know how things go with bills. Sometimes they get changed around. In fact, in the order of payment on these things are material, equipment, supplies delivered in the state. And then this is a surety bond to say that it wouldn't be owned by the company. The surety bond was being given to only these unsecured creditors that supplied the material, equipment, or supplies. And then after that, secondary would be labor and including employee benefits, and third would be taxes, et cetera. So there was an order of payment to try to direct this to the unsecured creditors and in that particular manner.
Okay.
Follow-up?
Yeah, through the chair. I mean, the other thing I suppose to look at, and this has been a long time for me, but there were ways using the Uniform Commercial Code, two chapters in particular, Article 2 on sales and Article 9 on secured transactions, where someone could try to perfect a security interest. And I don't know if that's even necessary if this gets done right. But I think what I hear you saying is that the department just needs more time to promulgate regulations. Is that the main impetus for this?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, yes, that's what the department's told us. And,
okay.
And you know, working through Ledge Legal, we were trying to figure out how could we do this in the surety bond or the cash bond payable to certain businesses was the only way that we had come up with as a possibility. I don't think this has been tested in court, and so we don't know for 100% that it will work. But if it's not payable to secured creditors, then we think that there's a more likelihood that the unsecured creditors wouldn't have to repay those amounts. There at least there would be some hurdle that would have to be jumped over for the bankruptcy lawyers, instead of just you know, issuing a letter that says you owe us this amount of money for fuel that or water that you had supplied to them and they had used and got paid for, and now we want you to pay us back because there's somebody else that wants the money.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Birch and then Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a kind of a general question on applicability across the board. I had a friend that was in the furniture business that called up Mark Air the day before they filed and said, you know, are you guys going to be okay? You know, and he kind of said, oh, sure. And they shipped, you know, 10 grand worth of furniture off to some spot out in the Aleutian chain that and it probably still sits out there today. But what is the oil and gas industry the only one that we apply a surety bond and cash deposit requirement of? And I'm not that familiar with this and was curious as to whether we're going to be doing this uniformly across, you know, whether it's a fish processor or aviation business or anybody else.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, this was targeting a specific problem that we had. We weren't trying to, which was Buccaneer was the first one that was really evident that there is no way for the suppliers to really know that somebody's getting ready to file bankruptcy or do those kind of things, and due diligence for a fuel supplier or somebody just, you know, selling something to a company is not the same kind of due diligence that secured creditors should be applying. And so this was specifically targeted at a problem that we had of small companies coming in without deep pockets, relying on state credits to finance their business. And then if anything would go wrong, then they went out of business, and small suppliers in Alaska being left on the hook. So this is not generally applicable across all businesses in Alaska. It was specifically targeted oil and gas. And it is required before you get an oil and gas license. So you have to have a license before you do that particular business. And so this attached to that business.
Through the chair, follow-up. You don't see any merit in applying a uniform type approach to other enterprises that might be similarly situated that are outside of the oil and gas business?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, whether there be merit or that or not, it's very complex. Mm-hmm. If you are targeting something that is broad across the entire business spectrum of Alaska. So this was an attempt to solve a problem that was being that required a state license to perform, and there was some due diligence by the state that wasn't adequate because we give them the license to perform and start drilling and doing those kind of things. So this was targeted at a certain aspect of what was proceeding, and we've seen it in several cases in Alaska and not general businesses. So whether someone else would like to expand something to general businesses, I think that would have a lot of impact if you were talking about every business in the state of Alaska. Yeah. To look at that. So this was targeting just a specific interest.
I'd just say my father-in-law was in the fuel business. He had a $60,000 fuel bill that was overpaid, and he basically hitched onto and confiscated $1.5 million airplane and basically held it until the fuel got paid. So, I mean, I think there are mechanisms out there to kind of cover your bases. I'm just not that familiar with this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, I was trying to remember a little bit with regard to the Buccaneer and the endeavor that they had there at the port of Homer. And if I recall, for the long time that they were there in the port, they did pay the city of Homer a particular amount of money, did they not? Because if I remember right, they had problems with the jackup rig, and so it was out in the port there, so they did pay the city, I don't know, $500,000 or something.
Through the chair, Representative, yes, there was a business relationship going on with the Port of Homer. Port of Homer, I think, had about $20,000 of port fees that were due, but more than anything, this was for people that supplied materials. This we're trying to target small businesses. So if you look down and you see that that would be the third tier. So in other words, the surety bond would be applied first to material, equipment, supplies mm-hmm. delivered in the state. Second, if there was still money left, would be labor, including employee benefits. And third would be taxes and other amounts due to a city, the borough, in that order, and then repair public facilities, and finally taxes and other amounts due to the mm-hmm. state. So this was really targeting and saying, if there's a company that goes bankrupt, and this wasn't satisfying contracts or anything, if the bankruptcy court would come and say, you as a supplier of materials to this outfit that had paid you and then went bankrupt, and within 90 days they could come back and make you, not only you gave them the fuel and they burned the fuel, but now you have to pay them back, pay the bankruptcy court for the cost of the fuel. And so that's what this was targeting, was trying to get to the small businesses and protect small businesses, because most small businesses really don't have any way to actually go in and do the due diligence on these companies that may not have as deep of pockets as they really need to be conducting the business they're in. Sure.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, thank you. That was what I was looking for, because the other part of it was that if they had paid the city of Homer a certain amount of money, were they also going after Homer then to try to get those fees back, like much of what they're doing with the other small businesses here? And that's what I was trying to find out.
And through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, yes, the city of Homer, I think, had to pay back, I can't remember, was $8,000 or $20,000 that was paid to them in port fees.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The case of the Buccaneer I don't know if the amount owed was $70,000, but that's the amount that the bankruptcy court is trying to take back. I guess cutting to the chase, is $250,000 enough, in your opinion, if there's several of these $70,000 type debts out there? Representative Seaton.
And through the chair, Representative Wohl, no. I mean, it depends on how far down the scale you're trying to go. If you're going to the first one, material, equipment, supplies delivered in the state, that's mostly the small businesses. And there could be some on the second one. Second criteria is labor, including employee benefits. You could have somebody providing some welding service or something, but this was not trying to go in and say you have a prime contractor and getting in between that relationship between a prime contractor and a oil company that's operating under this license. It was trying to say for the small unsecured people that are actually delivering a product that is used up, and now they not only don't have the product, but they had to pay the amount of money that right. the product was used for. So what we were trying to do was cover a specific range of small businesses that really don't have the ability in their normal operations to do the due diligence to figure out whether an oil company is has too thin a financial backup to be able and would go bankrupt.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Representative Seaton, I'm right with Representative Wool. It seems like with all the claims and the amount that was claimed, that and then the newspaper article in the end says 2 to 3 million is actually more appropriate, and I guess I would 100% agree with that. We know how many claims there was filed, but so I guess I'm wondering two questions. Why you chose on the $250,000 mark for the bond? And then secondly, you said in effect until they become into production, but Buccaneer actually was in production. They had the Kenai Loop gas fields. They were producing a fair amount of gas and good contracts. So I guess at what point do you think that they're able to get rid of that bond, I guess, would be my question. What's kind of the plan there?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, it's kind of one of those things like, how do you figure out, do you leave it on forever? It was my call early on to say, well, once someone goes into commercial production, there's probably something you can attach to. There's some value there. So there could be lawsuits the other way and as well. The problem is small operators, you know, if it's $20,000, you can't hire a lawyer and go after somebody for $20,000. I think the Representative Birch's example of he was owed $60,000 in fuel, so he attached the plane. Well, the plane, they weren't in bankruptcy. If they were in bankruptcy, you couldn't attach the plane, you know, and that was the problem. And so it's how to figure out a point that would be so that the operations have been going on long enough and they are now having actual production or have commercial production. So that was a call. I mean, you know, can somebody say that, yes, we should be just going forever? But that was one of the things that was kind of objected to as well. I mean, would we have ConocoPhillips and BP and everybody having to carry a surety bond and have it on the books forever? Or other folks, in Cook Inlet that came into production and they're an ongoing business. The intent here was to get to those that were coming in and exploring were small and would probably have thin financial resources. So
thank you. Representative Birch.
Do you have a sense for what the cost of a surety bond, whether it's a quarter of $1 million or whatever, do you have a incremental cost of the additional cost basically of providing that level of assurance through the chair?
If I remember right, when we were talking earlier, when we did this, they could tell us construction bond, which is kind of a surety bond. The performance bond was in the 2.3% or something like that per year. So, but I don't know what it is now, and that was one of the things that hopefully the department would find out as we went forward.
Thank you, and I think what we'll do now then is bring the department forward. Thank you, Representative Seaton.
Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Parity. Place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fred Parity. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and appreciate the chance to visit with you this afternoon. I want to begin by thanking Representative Seaton for bringing this legislation forward last session, and he's spent the last 6 months working with us as we try to implement these provisions that are going to be delayed by House Bill 229 should it pass. Speaking candidly, we did not foresee the complexities that are involved in implementing these bonding requirements as outlined in 4370.25. As with so many things, something that seems simple on the face of it, when you get into the details of it, it's considerably more complex than previously anticipated. Since the passage of 247 last year, our department has been working to find the least burdensome way to put these requirements into action, and that's 4370.025, which is the bond itself, and 4370.028, which is the pecking order for release of those funds. Those statutes provide important protections for small businesses who contract with oil and gas companies, and we are fully committed to implementing them. But if I may, I'd like to outline some of the obstacles that we've encountered. The first stumbling block we came across is seemingly innocuous, but it's the process of identifying which businesses to which the bond applies. All business licenses are associated with one or more North American Industry Classification System codes, NAICS. when Director Fagerstrom is, she's the lead business license person in the state of Wyoming, and or state of Alaska, excuse me, Freudian slip. When she dug into the details of it, there's some 23 different codes that you could consider, have petrochemical in the title, et cetera. We narrowed it down to applying to four, but as an example of the kind of problem you encounter, NAICS code 211111 is crude petroleum and natural gas extraction. You would never guess who has that as a secondary code attached to their business license. It's Yosubeli Coal. No one anticipates this applying to Yosubeli Coal, but nonetheless, when you look at those classification systems, you encounter that level of needing to sort out where it applies and when it doesn't. So it's important that we get right the application of the proper code into which businesses it applies. Because other surety bonds in our department, in Corporations Business Professional Licensing, our division within our department, they're attached to a professional license rather than to a business license. We don't currently have a process for attaching bonding requirements to business licenses without unnecessarily delaying business licenses for those who are not doing work that are subject to the bonding requirements for the specific NAICS code. So the regulatory framework for these statutes must include a simple way to identify which businesses are required to post a bond, and then we need a mechanism to release the bond when a company begins producing oil or gas in commercially viable quantities. Representative Knopp identified that in his questioning here this afternoon. That takes coordination between us and Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources, which we have been working on. We're actively engaged, but you're not trying to impose an undue burden. You're trying to make that process clear. If you think about releasing the surety bond based upon commercial production, what if you have a company who has commercial production in the North Slope, but the bond is applicable to an activity in Cook Inlet? There's a lot of questions to be sorted out there. There's also questions about subsidiaries and hierarchy. Which level of the company do you wish to attach the requirement to? So we have put forward a good faith effort to develop these regulations. We put out a scoping notice to solicit public comment and industry input. We received two comments, one response from ConocoPhillips. We believe a constructive solution can be found. However, implementing the statute without a sound regulatory framework is impractical for all parties involved, and therefore we approached Representative Seaton to seek the delay that's before you in the bill at hand.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Birch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm troubled. I mean, it seems like we're just kind of inching towards kind of a nanny state here where, you know, we're babysitting businesses that you don't, for one reason or another, don't have the wherewithal to, you know, research who their customers are and basically getting stiffed by a customer, which is terrible. One question I had, it relates to small business suppliers. Is there a size of business? In other words, if you're a Granger, that you're big enough that you basically you don't stand an opportunity to collect on a bill through the claims court. Whereas if you're if you're doing less than $1 million a year in revenues, that you do. I mean, do we have a mechanism for distinguishing between a really big company that's a supplier and a real, like it refers to small business suppliers? How do you distinguish between one and the other?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Birch, I would defer to Representative Seaton, the original sponsor, but would note that in 4370.028, when you list the pecking order of who gets paid, the first is material, equipment, and supplies delivered in the state. The second is labor, including employee benefits, and then it goes to taxes and repair public facilities. I think there's an effort in that identification to target your smaller targets, but there's not a definition of small business that's applicable to my knowledge.
So basically, through the chair then, so there's not really, in other words, you know, like I say, if you're Granger or a large multinational supplier versus a local supplier in Homer, there's no distinguishing between the two as far as recovering against either against the bond or the party that's gone bankrupt.
Mr. Chairman, again, I will defer to Representative Seaton, but to my best understanding, the hierarchy that's there was an effort to address that, but you have to be careful, as Representative Josephson alluded to, when you consider bankruptcy laws and what's applicable. You can't easily draw an Alaska-only distinction. You've got to be careful in how you deal with creditors in that regard. But, of course, this is intended to address unsecured creditors as opposed to secured creditors.
And lastly, are you familiar, does this apply to any other businesses or any other enterprises in the state or in any other state that you're familiar with where the state of Alaska actually intercedes to require a backstop on a contract, either in Wyoming or Alaska or anywhere else? I'm just not that familiar with the state kind of intervening to protect, if you will, suppliers in this manner.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Birch. I'm not familiar with the research that was done to bring this concept forward. I'm not aware of a similar provision in another oil and gas state, but this is statute that's applicable within the state of Alaska. What's the challenge is how to find out how to make it work, and we need more time to do so.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Parody, so I guess you're putting a lot of questions in my mind, but you talked about the complexities, and I wondered about that, trying to implement this. So it really is a consumer protection measure is what it is, small business consumer protection in that sense. You're trying to protect a small business person against a bad deal in that sense. So, but it brings to mind, I wonder, I wonder, with the repeal of HB 247, the actual need for it now, we don't have that incentive to reinvigorate Cook Inlet any longer, so most focus will be on the North Slope. If it was a $2 or $3 million bond, I think I'd be all over it, because it's obvious that we're spending some time trying to figure this out for, I'm going to say, a little bit of benefit. And so I wonder about that, and I'm going to ask you to weigh in on my comments. Here's where I'm going with my question. So it's obviously you guys have struggled through it. You're a year back now, and we don't know how much going forward, how much effort you're going to put into doing this. If it was a larger measure and on a $250,000 bond, and I'm just wondering, if that newspaper article shows there were so many claims in that $70,000-$80,000 range, you're not covering very many people, if it was divisible. So I guess that is my question. How much effort are we going to, is the effort we're going to have to put into solving the complexities going to be worth the gain? Is there still really a need for it after the repeal of 247? And I guess I'm also wondering about the requirements of who's going to have to post it. Is it somebody who is financially dependent on borrowing money from the state or looking forward to the generous credits we offered? Is that what's going to define, who's going to determine when a bond needs to be posted? What are going to be the requirements for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knopp, I would like to narrow your question, if I might, Mr. Chairman, because you're asking broader, not philosophical questions, but broader questions about equity and fairness and small business. And I believe you're referring not to the repeal of 247, but to the repeal of oil and gas tax credits, et cetera, in general. But 247 has not been repealed. It is a current statute which we are tasked with implementing. So the path we're trying to find forward is how to implement it effectively, and we're seeking a delay so we can do so. So some of the larger questions you're asking, I would punt back to the wisdom of the legislature. You're the ones that gave us the statute, and as you work your way forward with it, there may be tweaks needed. I can't speak really to the size of the bond. I can speak to the reality of what brought Representative Seaton's measure forward. I sit on the board of ADA, and you had a situation where secured creditors were their place in the pecking order, if you will, was firmly established, but unsecured small Alaska businessmen were left holding the bag. So given that impact, the amount that was set upon at $250,000 was a judgment call. I am not aware, Representative Birch, to your earlier question to Representative Seaton as to the cost of the bond. Mr. Chairman Seaton referenced a 2.5% or 2.3%. In earlier parts of my career, I've done mine reclamation bonding that ran 2.5%. So at that level, a $250,000 bond can cost you $6,500, $7,500, something on that order. So it's not nothing. But as you increase the bond, if you went to a $2 or $3 million range, you increase that business cost accordingly. So I would leave those questions to the future and seek the delay that we're requesting so that we can try to do a decent job with this.
Follow up.
Thank you. Follow up.
And thanks. And you're correct. I did misspeak. It wasn't a repeal. 247 repealed some of the credits. So just for one question then, the one that I guess really haunts me, solving the complexities versus the gain in this, are we better to rethink this, or do we think it's going to be something we can do reasonably for what little guarantee we're going to offer?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might close in answer to that question, the little guarantee that we offer to a small business, a chunk of change of 60 or 100 grand or $250,000, is a substantive contribution to their future viability. So I think there's value in it, but the details of who it applies to, what NAICS code, how it's released, what constitutes commercial production, and what level of subsidiary is required to carry it, we need to find a path forward through that. And if we fail, we'll be back in front of you with additional information and back in front of Representative Seaton trying to match our regulatory framework to the direction that's been given us in this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Parity. And with that, I will open up public testimony. Seeing no one online, I'll go to the room. Is there anyone in the room like to provide public testimony on House Bill 229? Seeing none, we will set this bill aside. I do intend to bring the bill up again on Wednesday and fully intend to keep it moving forward. So thank you, Representative Seaton, Deputy Commissioner Parity, and Wednesday we will also have a presentation from the U.S. Census Bureau. That meeting will be 3:15 p.m. normal time, and with that we will stand adjourned at 3:55 p.m. on Monday, April 24th. Thank you.